accent to eight the positive and 11 manate the negative and latch on to the affirmative, but don't mess with Mr. In Between.
So do you find yourself worrying about what could go wrong all the time? Do you remember the bad times more than the good times in your life? Well, you're not alone, but our guest says it doesn't have to be that way. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are going to talk with the author of Hardwiring Happiness this hour, who says our brains are like Velcro for negative experiences and like Teflon for positive ones. But we can do something about that, and we will find out what. And we will welcome your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Do you find that negative experiences stick out in your mind more than positive ones or positive memories? What advice would you like on accentuating the positive? Our guest is Rick Hansen. He's a neuropsychologist, founder of the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom, and the author of Hardwiring Happiness, The New Brain Science of Contentment, Calm, and Confidence. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, that really put an image in my mind that our brains are like Velcro for negative experiences. Why do you say that?
Scientists call it the negativity bias of the brain. And the source of it is that as our ancestors evolved, they had to both, seek out rewards like so-called carrots, food, shelter, mating opportunities, and they had to avoid predators, sticks, quote-unquote, like lethal aggression in bands, as I said, predators, natural hazards, and so forth. The difference is, though, if you fail to get a carrot today, you'll probably have a chance at one tomorrow. But in the wild, if you fail to avoid that stick today, whap, no more carrots forever. So the brain has evolved this tendency to continually scan for bad news, zero in on it when it finds it, react to it intensely, and fast-track that whole experience into memory, especially emotional memory, for how life is. As a result, many studies show that people remember negative information about someone more than positive information. Mm-hmm. That's a major reason why most political ads go negative.
Mm-hmm.
Research also shows that a typical long, good, strong couple needs at least a 5-to-1 ratio of positive to negative interactions. That was a cautionary tale when I ran across that finding in grad school. It's easy to train people in helplessness. It's hard to undo it. We tend to learn faster from pain than from pleasure. The problem with all this is that besides darkening our mood, as it were, and making us more anxious and irritable and depressive, it also blocks our personal growth and character development. It makes it harder for us to become resilient and happy and loving because we actually build those inner strengths primarily from positive experiences, but the brain is very inefficient at turning those positive experiences into lasting neural structure. The experience might be good in the moment, but it has no lasting value. So what I've gotten interested in is how to pop open the bottleneck in the brain to help really convert the experiences we're having every day and make use of them so that they build up inner strengths inside us.
Well, on the other hand, if evolution caused us to remember the negative in a way as a part of a survival mechanism, doesn't reversing that come at a cost?
That's a great question. In terms of pure survival, for people living in terrible conditions, which unfortunately is all too common in the world, as you well know, then it makes sense, right? As our ancestors evolved, for example, in a typical hunter-gatherer band, 5 out of 6 babies were dead before they turned 6 years old. I mean, these are very, very harsh conditions. But today, and certainly in the developing world, as it were, for most people, this bias doesn't actually help us survive better. It actually clouds our thinking with false threats. We get very worried about little things, and we fail to worry properly about the big things. And more generally, at a time when our ancestors evolved to usually be dead by their 30th birthday, right? These days, though, the long-term costs of the short-term benefits of being stressed and burdened, including the health burden that this creates is no longer worth the bargain. And my own view is that there's a middle way, as it were. In other words, I don't think it's appropriate to so-called look on the bright side or practice the power of positive thinking, which is usually wasted on the brain. It doesn't build any structure. But it's to see the whole mosaic of reality clearly, the good and the bad, recognizing that the Stone Age bias is to over-focus on the bad and not learn much from it. That's particularly my focus. It's how can we actually learn from the useful experiences that we're having every day rather than wasting them, you know, 10 or 20 seconds at a time, because that's about how long it actually takes to transfer from short-term buffers to long-term storage.
Well, what is it about positive experiences that cause them not to stick with us like the negative ones do?
Yeah, they use standard-issue memory systems. So negative experiences get fast-tracked. Once burned, twice shy, right? Never forget. If you, if you're an animal, you know, an ancient primate or mammal or going all the way back, reptiles and jellyfish, et cetera, if you ever escape that lethal threat, you better remember what happened, right? So negative experiences have, let's say, dedicated memory systems, whereas positive experiences move through this two-stage process from activation to installation. In other words, the experience is held, it's represented in a short-term memory buffer, and then if we stay with it long enough, it'll transfer to long-term storage. It'll begin its encoding process. Well, that's great, except how many of us actually stay with a positive experience 5, 10, 20 seconds in a row, helping it be rich and very felt in the body and even intense, so we get as many, quote-unquote, neurons firing together, so they wire together. Now, if we don't do that, if we don't take that extra 5, 10, 20 seconds, and it kind of depends, how long depends on the situation, the person, but mo beta. You know, I'm from California, basically, mo beta. You know, and if we don't do that, the experience is momentarily pleasant. It's an activated mental state, but it doesn't become installed as a lasting neural trait. That's the distinction between negative and positive experiences, and that's also why there's an opportunity that half a dozen times a day, if you will, in key positive experiences that we're already having in the flow of life, not million-dollar moments on the 0 to 10 intensity scale ones and twos, but instead of wasting them, if we actually let them land, you know, a moment of feeling liked by somebody or a moment of accomplishing something like an email or, you know, getting a child to bed, what have you, or off to school, or a moment of recognizing some good quality in ourselves or feeling grateful in some way or having some kind of even spiritual experience register in us. If we just take the extra 10, 20 seconds, it actually steepens our learning curve in that moment. And then as those moments accumulate, it steepens our growth curve in general.
Well, let's talk about the HEAL method that you have for hardwiring happiness. First off, what is it? What do those letters stand for?
Yeah. As I said, learning hundreds, probably thousands at this point, of studies on the neuropsychology of learning show that it's this two-stage process, activation to installation. In other words, the brain is not like an iPod or like Neo in the movie The Matrix, where you just plug a cable in the back of the head and suddenly you can fly a helicopter or do kung fu or something like that. The brain is more like an old-school cassette recorder. We record it. In other words, we grow the strength inside us by actually playing the song. So we have to sustain the activation to begin the installation. So what I do in my little acronym, which summarizes a whole lot of studies on learning, I didn't invent, you know, the nature of learning. I'm just trying to apply it to the development of resilience, happiness, and other inner strengths. The first step in the acronym HEAL, H-E-A-L, is to have a positive experience in the first place, usually because you simply notice one you're already having. You know, you already have a sense of, let's say, relaxation or sense of comfort with somebody else. Our elderly cat is lying here on my desk as I speak with you today. It makes me happy to look at him, right? And then the remaining steps go into the installation phase, although I should add that it's perfectly appropriate under the first step, activation or have a positive experience in the first place, to create one. I mean, if you're dealing with a tough situation, to call up a sense of strength. I've done a lot of rock climbing, and if I have to deal with a hard thing or be assertive, sometimes I'll just pull up a two-second feeling in my body, you know, of what it is to pull over an overhang or something. Or we might bring up a sense of our grandmother who loved us, or a time that we made something beautiful and gave it to someone and they were grateful. You know, whatever. It's appropriate to be able to self-activate useful states of mind at will. That's very foundational for coping and mental health. Okay, H for have. And then quickly here, going into the installation phase, you can enrich the experience, E for enrich, through any one of five well-known factors that promote learning, specifically duration, helping it last, you know, staying with it 5, 10, 20 seconds in a row, help it become more intense as appropriate, you know, feel it more fully, open to it, let it happen inside yourself. It's all quite private and enjoyable, which mm-hmm. is a nice thing too. You can also, as you feel it more in your body, as it's more multimodal, so-called, you'll get more of those quote-unquote neurons firing together so they wire together. Novelty is another factor for enriching because the brain is a big novelty detector. It's always looking for what's new. So trying to see what might be fresh in an experience of gratitude or compassion for someone or feeling cared about. And then last, personal relevance. We remember what's salient, what matters to us. Okay, those are five factors under E for enrich. And A for absorb. We can sensitize our memory systems so that the good experiences really land inside us and become more efficiently or effectively encoded in the moment by intending and even sensing that we're absorbing the experience. Those are the three primary steps that move from activation to installation to help the learning occur from the useful experience. And then the fourth step is optional. It's the L for link, in which we both are aware of something positive, which is prominent in the foreground of awareness, as well as something negative off to the sides. For example, we might have a strong sense of being loved and cared about today with, off in the background, some sense of growing up perhaps, or maybe in our first marriage or job, what have you, a sense of being dismissed or devalued or, you know, abandoned by others. So that gradually the positive experience held in awareness, 10 or 20, 30 seconds at a time, starts associating with the negative material, gradually soothing it, easing it, and eventually replacing it.
So why is that optional?
Oh, that's a good question. because many times people are not in the moment going to want to be aware of the negative, right? They are just staying with purely positive. Maybe they're wanting to grow inside themselves more of a sense of feeling less anxious. And so what they might do is they would work on a sense of relaxing or feeling more protected or feeling stronger inside themselves or registering the simple fact that in this moment, at least, their body is telling them they're all right now. That all the focus there is entirely positive. There's nothing negative at all. Then if someone wants to, they certainly could bring to mind some of those, in my example here, negative feelings of anxiety or worry or apprehensiveness or unease, so that the positive associates with it. But it's a little more challenging to be aware of both positive and negative at once. The key is to make the positive more prominent, so it's what goes into the negative rather than the other way around. And as a longtime therapist, you know, I respect the power of the dark side of the force, as it were. You know, negative material can kind of grab hold of people. The point altogether is that, you know, half a dozen times a day, half a minute at a time or less, actually, you can really increase your general sense of well-being and resilience and even healing by drawing upon the power that's present in everyday experiences, which is unfortunately usually wasted because of the negativity bias of the brain, this bottleneck that it has.
Let me jump in because we want to invite callers to join us to talk about how to hardwire happiness. We just heard Rick Hansen tell us about the HEAL method for hardwiring happiness. Have a positive experience, enrich it, absorb it, and perhaps link positive and negative material so that the positive will soothe and even replace the negative. And we welcome your questions for him. We welcome your own experiences. Do you find that negative experiences stick out in your mind more than positive ones? How do you, or what do you do to try to remember or grasp on to positive experiences in in memories? Do you keep a journal? Do you write thank you notes? So what would you like to know? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
My life is sunshine.
We are talking about hardwiring happiness, the new brain science of contentment, calm, and confidence. And we are welcoming your questions for our guest expert, Rick Hansen, who is a neuropsychologist and author of the book Hardwiring Happiness. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. How can we make life's good moments, our positive experiences, stick like Velcro to our minds and downplay the negative times or the negative memories? That's what we are learning about this hour, how we can hardwire happiness. And we have a number of callers, so let's go right to the phones. Terry in Postville, Illinois is with us. Hello, Terry.
Hi, it's Postville, Iowa.
Oh, I'm sorry, Iowa. Go ahead.
Yep, no, not a problem. Well, I inflict positive thoughts by take a lot of pictures, family photos and grandkids and my animals. And in fact, a few years ago when I started having grandchildren, I have one wall in my living room that's entirely photos and of my grandchildren. And when I look at them, it just makes me smile and brings back all the positive, fun, great memories. And
having those photos up maybe will help the good times stick to our brains like Velcro, Rick Hansen?
It's a great way to have a positive experience in the first place. And, I really appreciate that kind of inventiveness. You know, we have a hallway ourselves where we have pictures of our children and so forth. The question, of course, always is, you know, how much of that is actually sinking in, right? How much of those positive experiences of happiness and joy are sinking in? I think intuitively people tend to savor and register positive experiences, but very often, number one, we hardly notice good facts around us. Second, if we do, we don't have much of an experience. And third, even if we have an experience, whether it's looking at photos of our grandchildren or our cat on the desk or feeling like we've, you know, gotten something done today, how often do we actually stay with it, that critical period, 5, 10, 20 seconds in a row, to transfer into long-term storage so it builds something strong inside us? That's always my question here. And I think that methods that people have are fantastic for having a positive experience in the first place. That's terrific. But one thing that I've been quite humbled about, honestly, as a longtime therapist and as a parent and a teacher, is how often the momentary positive experience that my students or clients, whatever children had cultivated, was present in the moment, was actually wasted on the brain, you know, flowing through it like water through a sieve, while negative experiences get caught and transferred to memory, you know, every single time. So that would be my suggestion for the caller to double check, and she may already be just doing it naturally and intuitively, to just let the experience land, to kind of open to it, give it to herself, take the extra 5-10 seconds to really let it sink in. And you know, if she wants to, it could even connect with, who knows, some perhaps negative material of you know, feeling less connected to others than she might like or not being happy about something. But as I've said before, that fourth step is purely optional.
I had a wonderful experience this weekend, Dr. Hansen. I ended up seeing some really old friends from my first job out of college. It was Channel 7 in Wausau. We had a mini reunion of many people who were hired way back in the old days, and we got together for the first time in like 30 years, and we paid tribute to our news director, Mark Zelich, and I'm going to do it publicly now, too. Thank you, Mark Zelich, for giving us our start, and we just had a wonderful, wonderful time. Now, how do I absorb that? How do I make that stick to my mind like Velcro?
Oh, sure. Well, we all know how to take in the good. We just tend to not do it. You would stay with the experience. You would notice that you're having it. Mindfulness helps here, self-awareness. So kind of quietly inside yourself, you know, you let the glow last. You kind of protect it. And what a lot of people discover when they start doing this kind of thing is, oddly, that it's hard to actually let themselves have a positive experience and help it last. Many people discover this, and there's a variety of reasons, including their mind just wandering a bit. But beyond that, sometimes they have feelings like they don't deserve it, or it would be vain somehow to let it in, or that their job in life is to make sure that others are happy instead of themselves. So make sure that you're actually a friend to yourself, that you're on your own side, you're an ally to yourself. It doesn't mean that you're against others, it just means that you're for yourself. The other thing to bring up here, if someone wants to, in terms of our, as we evolved, I go into this in the book, during the reptilian, mammalian, and primate stages of evolution, we developed more and better ways to address our three fundamental needs for safety, satisfaction, and connection, which link to the reptilian, mammalian, and primate-human stages of brain evolution. So, for example, if someone is having an experience that's very relational, as you've mentioned and Terry mentioned as well with her grandchildren, that positive experience is like a targeted antidote for any kind of old pain or stress or loss or neglect that has to do with relationship experiences, you know, feeling hurt, put down, left out, unwanted, et cetera, et cetera. It's also possible that if a person's having different kinds of positive experiences, let's say experiences more around in the range of feeling safe or protected or strong, those are good targeted antidotes for issues in the safety system, the more ancient reptilian, you know, brain, the brain that evolved at times when, you know, rule one was to eat lunch today, don't be lunch today, right? Mm-hmm. So you can connect those experiences of strength, say, to feelings of anxiety in the safety system. Or if a person has felt frustrated or disappointed or like they've been thwarted or failed, look for opportunities in the more mammalian satisfaction system of the brain, the reward-seeking part of the brain, whether you feel grateful or glad or accomplished or experiencing pleasure, to address those kind of needs. So working backwards, just finishing up, if you have a sense of, ask yourself, what would make a difference? What would make a good difference for me or my child or my student, my client, whatever? What would make a big difference if it were more present in my mind? In other words, how could I grow that trait inside myself? And then it will typically follow, how could I start having experiences of that trait or related factors and then help them sink into myself so I carry them with me wherever I go?
I'm Joy Cardine talking with Rick Hansen. He is author of Hardwiring Happiness, The New Brain Science of Contentment, Calm, and Confidence. And we're finding out how we can rewire or hardwire our brains to remember the positive and downplay the negative. It's usually the other way around in our brains. Let's go to Deborah in Waukegan. Hello, Deborah.
Hi. I just wanted to tell a little story that's so similar to what the doctor is talking about. I had always thought of myself as not being good at visualizing. You know, like when you read things, you visualize the army marching or just visualizing in general. And then one day, I was thinking about something that I was kind of dreading, and I realized that, no, when I was scared about something for the future, that I had this absolute glorious technicolor ability to visualize the worst that could happen. You know, I was expert at visualizing in that area, and the minute I noticed it, I just started laughing, you know, and realized that I had specialized that ability just to the negative. And no, I didn't lack the ability. I just was using it sort of, again, not in my own best interest. And ever since I noticed that, you know, it's, first of all, I notice when I do it. And secondly, it's really strengthened my sense of having a perfectly good ability to visualize.
Isn't that interesting? So full color a visualization of the negative, but not for the positive, Rick Hansen.
Oh, I think that's a great example, Deborah, and I won't use your name, but I may repeat that example for other people with your permission. That's great. It's exactly right. We're very good. I think somebody, maybe Oscar Wilde, said, most of the terrible things in my life never happened to me. In other words, we're really good at anticipating bad events or ruminating. There's this factor called negative rumination in psychology, where we just rehash things. You know, we work, go over and over again conversations, or we think about our resentments about other people, or we criticize ourselves again and again and again. you know, for relatively small faults. We're not a friend to ourselves. We don't, you know, it's interesting. The golden rule is a two-way street. You know, we should do unto ourselves as we actually do unto others, which generally is to treat them better, you know, than we treat ourselves. So to me, the takeaway is, again, you know, who's in charge of the structures, of the structure-building processes in our own Stone Age brain? Willy-nilly, it is inclining to the negative, and then also forces outside us, the media, other people, or the legacy of our own past inside our head today, is continually sculpting our brain. I think that the essence of self-reliance, actually, is to take responsibility for the sculpting processes of our own brain from the inside out. And one of the very best ways to do this, and a very enjoyable one, is to tap the power in everyday positive experiences to grow these strengths inside ourselves.
What an interesting example, Deborah. Thank you so much for calling. Rick Hansen, we didn't really talk about, maybe touched on it, but specifically, what kinds of differences will we notice if we are able to, you know, do your heal process and hardwire our brains to accentuate the positive, I guess?
Sure. There are many paths. There are many ways to grow personally, and people do this in informal ways. My relatives come from North Dakota. I have a strong sense of those roots, as it were, and Midwestern. You know, just in everyday life, we have opportunities to realize that we got through a hard time and that we were stronger than we had thought, or we find inside ourselves a wellspring, speaking of that word, of love for our children that we didn't know was there, and we let it land. You know, we change as a result. What interests me is how to do this learning process in a very powerful and effective way, drawing on the common sense applications of the research on emotional learning and emotional development. So if we're growing psychologically, the brain has got to change, because what else is it, right? Scientists have known for a century or more this idea of experience-dependent neuroplasticity, that as we think or feel or pay attention to various things, that's constantly sculpting our brain. So if you've grown, and I think everybody has had the experience of growing psychologically in some way, they know for sure that their brain has changed. If you explore the methods in my book and, you know, apply them in 5-10 minutes a day, if that, you'll probably notice within a few days that you'll start feeling more confident, more centered in yourself. It'll basically benefit you in three kinds of ways. If you'll forgive me, I'll just list these quickly. First is that if you think of the mind-brain system as like a garden, there are three ways to relate to it. We can just witness it, we can pull weeds in it, or we can plant flowers. My focus is on one of those three, which is planting flowers in the garden of the mind. It's only one of the three ways to engage the mind, but it's a really good way to do it. So the first type of benefit that people would notice if they start practicing the heal process is they would start growing more particular things inside themselves. I think we all know what would be helpful to have more inside, more feeling loved, perhaps, more inner peace, more sense of resilience, toughness, more happiness, just generally, more of a sense of gratitude. Who knows? Okay, so we get those flowers. The second type of benefit is built in implicitly into the act itself, because when you take in the good, you've got to be on your own side. You've got to treat yourself like you matter, which is an implicit benefit, and especially an important one for people who haven't felt like they've mattered enough to others. Also, it brings your awareness more and more, kind of what Deborah was saying, to the good things that are actually present in life. And then the third type of benefit is that you might be able to gradually sensitize your brain to the positive. In other words, the brain is has built-in systems that, when life is difficult, make it increasingly reactive to the negative. So it learns more and more quickly from them, which is a good way for survival, but it perpetuates stress inside our bodies, especially traumatic stress. On the other hand, it looks like that as people increasingly savor positive experiences and register them and really, you know, use the heal process I've described to let it sink in, that they actually become more sensitized to the positive. They actually develop a brain that's increasingly like Velcro for the good.
Let's take a call from David in Laval now. Hello, David. You're on the air.
Hello. Morning. I'm an alcoholic, and all those memories seem to hang and come anywhere I go. It's like, boom, it comes back, those bad things. But it's gotten better. In retirement, I have found that I can sit and say, this is good. One of my points is I think it's hard for alcoholics, I've got 20-some years recovered, to recover because they're just haunted. I call them the ghosts. It's like one of the people in treatment center said, read Christmas Carol. It's about an alcoholic. And I've always, this ghost is always these ghosts. But generally speaking, I've gone through what the author, the professor is talking about, positive affirmation, gratitude, it's an attitude. But anyway, I wanted to bring up that alcoholic difficulty. Thank you.
Thank you. Rick Hansen?
Well, I appreciate that, and you know, I respect people tremendously, including David, who have sustained a sobriety. I think it's one of the more really admirable things that people can do, and that's, I would say directly, that's an important thing to let it sink in part to offset those experiences or memories that quote-unquote haunt us, where we feel maybe we let others down or we made, you know, major mistakes and so forth. That could well be true, and there are lessons to be learned from that. On the other hand, it's really important to offset those ghosts, you know, rattling around inside the mind. One more example of the negativity bias, with multiple experiences of really registering a targeted antidote for them, such as experiencing that you are a good person through sustaining sobriety or being a friend to others, perhaps being a sponsor for others, or otherwise just one day at a time. Showing up and doing the hard thing. There's a lot of basis in that for recognizing one's own good qualities, and then in particular, letting the sense of that sink in, install it, so it's not wasted on the brain. The second thing to say, I think, is that, you know, do not underestimate the power of little things. It's very interesting. It's lots of little things that get us to a bad place. It's typically lots of little good things to get us to a better one. And we just did a study through the University of California at Berkeley on this course I created on taking in the good. It's just a six-week course. It's not a very big thing, you know. And yet, at the end of the course, compared to a weightless control group, and we found that people had more sense of satisfaction in life, even after 2 months after the course, which is a pretty robust finding, and given the fact that we didn't have a particularly large sample, so you need a large effect size. You need to have something pretty robust to get significance there. As well as people after the course compared to the beginning had a lot more gratitude and self-compassion. Again, speaking to David's point, self-compassion is critically important for dealing with being hard on ourselves, those ghosts inside us, remorse, regret, guilt, feelings of inadequacy. You know, self-compassion is the natural antidote for that, and we can grow that. And we found in our study that people did that, as well as other kinds of happiness. You know, they have a saying in Tibet, if you take care of the minutes, the years will take care of themselves, which I really like. You know, it's not just one day at a time, it's 1 minute at a time. But that's, to me, both very hopeful, because that's where we have influence, but it's also very responsible. Like I said earlier, taking in the good, you know, taking charge of the structure-building processes of our brain is, to me, the essence of self-reliance. I mean, it's on us to do what we can, you know, with the good that's available to us in the next minute, right? The most important minute of our life, the next one, minute after minute after minute.
Rick Hansen is a neuropsychologist, founder of the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom, and author of Hardwiring Happiness, the New Brain Science of Contentment, Calm, and Confidence. And we are talking about how we can hardwire our brains for happiness. We welcome your questions, too, and your experiences. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about happiness and how we can hardwire our brains for happiness. Our guest says that our brains are like Velcro for negative experiences and Teflon for positive ones. And We are talking about how we can hardwire our brains to start turning positive experiences into contentment and confidence. And we're welcoming your questions for neuropsychologist Rick Hansen. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our next caller is Rich in Rhinelander. Hello, Rich.
Hello. I mean to be fair to your guest and author in my comments, but this listener comes from a long line of labor activists who worked in the paper mills here in northern Wisconsin. And we were the people who, working in paper mills, for all their lives, recognized that management would set out coffee and donuts when a production goal had been reached. And we stood back with our arms folded and said, no, it's not coffee and donuts we want. We want better wages, safer working conditions, and so on and so forth. And I'm also a big fan of author Barbara Ehrenreich's Brightsided, where she writes about being sort of Pollyannish towards life, that is, women in breast cancer survival support groups hearing things like, cancer is the best thing that ever happened to me, meaning it changed their life remarkably. And I think your guest's message fits, to me at least, on some limited personal level. But I would want to say that if 50% of the people are getting divorces in their marriages, from their marriages, perhaps that means that they're coming to some realization about the trajectory of their life. It doesn't mean that they're necessarily wrong. Some, of course, may be mistaken about their decisions. But if anything, North Dakota is even more Minnesota nice as a population than Minnesota. And some of us were born and educated in some sense of the word, coming from Chicago, Illinois.
Yeah,
where...
Rich, can you kind of target this to our, you know, a question for our guest or a point? Are you saying that we shouldn't hardwire our brains for happiness because that's just putting
blinders
on it?
No, not at all. I think we should be aware that there are people who know how to sell us certain ideas and are manipulative, and for the naive and unsophisticated, people can be convinced of doing what's not in their best interest by niceness when they actually should be opposing manipulation by others who simply use them.
Yeah, thank you. Rick Hansen, do you have a reaction to that?
Oh, I completely agree with Rich. And that's why I said at the very beginning that I think that so-called looking on the bright side or the power of positive thinking is actually misplaced for two reasons. One, it ignores the very real problems in the world, whether it's, you know, the problem in the person that you're married to and you discover you've got to make a change, or the ways in which, you know, many people, including in the labor movement, obviously historically, have not been treated with dignity and respect and, you know, their fair share of the pie. So I think that just looking on the bright side, as it were, positive thinking, rose-colored glasses, is totally inappropriate. If anything, the focus in the book is about growing strength inside in a world that's hard and in a world in which many forces outside us are not doing a very good job of promoting justice and so forth. So the question for me is, in a tough situation, right, what are we going to do from the inside out? And one of the opportunities there is to help our brain grow, help our brain literally change for the better over time. And the question then becomes, you know, are we going to take that opportunity or not? And it's completely true that people who, you know, want to get us to focus on, you know, the good news, la-di-da, you know, to sell us down the river, I think that's totally inappropriate. On the other hand, if we do not use opportunities to
you know, become stronger inside. And again, I think people do use these opportunities in natural ways already. What I'm really focused on is how to do it very effectively and powerfully and efficiently, given the nature of the brain itself, you know, in very down-to-earth and common-sense ways. If we do not use opportunities in daily life to grow these various strengths inside, including a sense of solidarity with others or determination or resilience, or a sense, frankly, that we deserve a fairer shake. Those are strengths you can grow inside yourself. If we don't use opportunities to do that, you know, we tend to get progressively ground down in a lot of ways, or it's easier to get ground down by the hard things in life. So I don't have any disagreement with Rich. I really appreciate his point. And my own thrust is very much against the kind of, you know, as I say, I live in California. I've had my fair share of encounters there. My thrust is just, in a sense, is against the la-di-da approach to life. And it's much more on a sense of, okay, how are we going to do it? How are we going to grow these things inside ourselves?
Thanks, Rich, for the call. Judith in Superior is with us now. Hi, Judith.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Fascinating subject. My children were in grade school during the flush of the first video cams when they were big and clunky and heavy. And I realized that by videotaping all of their school programs and birthdays and whatnot, I was having more of an interaction with the equipment than with the event that was going on. And I'm wondering what your guest thinks about how that may interfere with hardwiring the experience. I stopped doing it. I much preferred to just watch their programs and enjoy it and make it a part of my memory.
Oh, I think, Judith, you're right. And, you know, there actually are concerns these days that parents, including mothers, you know, are the primary caregiver of young children, you know, the majority of situations, are just caught up in technology. I actually saw a situation like that at an airport, you know, Starbucks area, having some coffee where these two young children were trying to get their mother's attention who was busily texting. And my first book was about taking good care of mothers over the long haul. It's really stressful and depleting to be a mother in many ways. So, you know, I think there's a place for having respite and so forth. But if your experience in any situation, whether it's parents, you know, videotaping their kids or engaging technology while they're with their children, or teenagers so-called studying while, you know, instant messaging their friends and listening to music at the same time, that will all disrupt the installation phase of learning, emotional learning as well as cognitive learning, let's say, in school, and will make it less powerful for us. The takeaway point for me is to help these experiences be powerful and strong. I mean, there's a place for the getting out the video camera. I cannot tell you how many hours of tape we have, which I finally digitized for our own kids. But, you know, on the other hand, we evolved to look people in the eye, right, not send them a message on Facebook. We evolved to touch people, to be with them directly. And those are the kind of experiences that are going to build up the strongest traces inside us, woven into the fabric of our brain and therefore our life.
Thank you, Judith, for that. Michelle in Dubuque is with us next. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. I have actually worked on many of these positive thinking strategies and things over the last few years myself, noticing very big differences in my ability to cope with things, but also have noticed that my children as well really benefit, as the last caller was saying, from numerous of the things that I have been doing as well. Any suggestions from the speaker today on how to maybe encourage these activities with our children in this society that we live in now? One of the things that we've been doing is we have a gratitude bucket that we use every day that our kids put a couple of positive thoughts in or things that they're thankful for every day. And we find that that keeps us focused on the positive and not maybe the stressful things going on in our life.
How about a gratitude bucket, Rick Hansen?
I think it's a great idea, and I've known people who've done other kinds of things as well with children. I mean, for example, a moment of gratitude at a meal is a natural opportunity for that. Another powerful method is with children who will put up with a little psychobabble to extend their bedtime for a few minutes, you know, roughly ages 4 to 12, 4 to 14, somewhere in there, is to take a moment when we're putting them to bed to help a child call up a positive experience. It could just be one in general, or it could be, as I said earlier, one of these targeted antidote experiences that are aimed at, that are the natural medicine for, if you will, some issue that a child might have. For example, if a child's anxious about sleeping alone, you know, calling up a sense of being protected or relaxing or a sense of being strong inside, for example. Or for a child who's struggling in school a bit, maybe, you know, reading isn't coming along very well, whatever, looking for opportunities to experience a sense of accomplishment, at least succeeding in some other part of life, you know, whether it's making cookies or scoring a goal in soccer or being a good friend or a good big sister. Okay. And then at night with the child during this period, that's very, the brain is very like a sponge just before going to sleep. It's hypnagogic, that's the term. And what I mean is that if we call to mind a state of mind just before sleep, and then we really let it sink in, that is going to have typically a pretty good impact. So I've actually known a number of families that have done this little practice, you know, a minute or two or three before going to sleep, not getting all complicated or psychological about it, keeping it really informal and really natural. I've known a number of parents who've come up to me later, and you know, a few weeks after a few weeks have passed, to say, "Wow, this was particularly effective." And kind of last point here, implicit in what I think Michelle was saying was this point that kids in our culture, you know, let's say in the West broadly defined, on the one hand, are stressed and pressed. You know, they're pushed, they're scheduled into a lot of situations, they're put in situations that are not natural really for a, you know, a child, particularly a younger child, to sit quietly and in a classroom, you know, or even move around a bit, but to be in that environment for, you know, 6 hours a day. And also the other thing is, partly because we are fortunate some often materially, kids get the idea that the primary source of their well-being is outside themselves, with the next toy or TV show or technology or, you know, post on Facebook or whatever, that it's externally sourced. And I think that, you know, it's okay to have fun with external stuff, but ultimately it leaves us hollow inside. And then if that external supply chain ever dries up, we are left feeling like we're running on empty. That's why I think it's important for children to help them actually take the extra 10, 20 seconds at a time. Kids are faster than adults because they're more efficient at learning, their brains are. Let the good experience sink in so that the child develops more of a sense that the source of their well-being, their feelings of love and being loved and loving, et cetera, come from the inside out principally, which will then make that child or help that child become increasingly independent, you know, and self-reliant and resilient.
Rick Hansen, I'm sorry, we only have a minute to go. Can you, I really wanted to talk about your 21 Days of Good that you talk about in the book, but maybe in this final minute, you can tell us something we can do today to get started on hardwiring our brains for happiness.
Oh, that's great. Thanks. Well, in the book, there's a lot of practice. It's a very practical book. There's a lot of practices. And one thing people can do related to, as I said earlier, the reptilian, mammalian, primate stages of evolution, the sort of, at least in myself, I experience a kind of inner lizard, inner mouse, and inner monkey, is look today for a simple experience of feeling that you're actually all right right now, in this moment. And as it were, pet the lizard. Also, you could today, if you wanted, look for an opportunity for gratitude and, as it were, feel rewarded, satisfied, you know, feed the mouse, quote unquote. It's a silly metaphor, but it works, for me at least. And then today, look for an opportunity to feel cared about, you know, as it were, hug the monkey. And that could take a minute or less and could really feel different for you.
Thank you so much for being with us. Rick Hansen is the author of Hardwiring Happiness. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster, to Bill Martins, and to Christy Taylor for producing this program. This is the Ideas Network.